Well, to be specific, it's actually gerrymandering because it comes from Governor Gary's name, who was a mayor of or a governor of Massachusetts back in the 1800s, during the founding times of our country, when there was a battle royale between his party and another famous figure from the founding father days, Patrick Henry. And the lines were drawn in such a way that they resembled the shape of a salamander, and a enterprising reporter called it a gerrymander because the lines were so distorted in order to be able to excise Patrick Henry from a seat and give Governor Gary's party the advantage. That name has stuck, but over time it's evolved into a more current way of saying it, which is gerrymander.
And about what year was that?
Oh, you're going to crucify me. It's probably in the 1700s.
So this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty much since the founding days of our country.
And how is it applied in the modern world? How do we see it play out?
So what we see is that the way that redistricting is generally done is that there's a party in charge of our legislature, generally the majority party of a state. Their leaders will be the ones who control how the lines get drawn. Oftentimes, where the legislature draws their own lines, they go behind closed doors. You'll hear stories of them renting a hotel room across the street from a legislature. They'll parade individual members from their own party one by one into a secret room where somebody's drawing the lines. And then oftentimes those lines are then introduced into the legislature as a bill midnight or 4 a.m., and there's a rush vote to pass it along party lines. That closed-door process is something where, unfortunately, when state legislatures control their own line drawing, they oftentimes will not only squeeze out the other party, but they will protect their own incumbents in a way that eliminates true choice for voters, and it eliminates the ability for challengers to come up and really give them a run for their money. And oftentimes it also can lead to corruption and non-responsive elected officials, because literally they're just elected again and again. There's nobody running against them. They've kind of cut out any challengers from their district, and so they're running without challenge, without accountability.
Because they have these districts that are very heavily handmade, Republican or Democrat.
Yeah, they're handmade for them. Sometimes it's a super protective seat for the incumbent, and a lot of times it is a super protective seat for that particular party that's in control. We've had a number of cases recently, and the two that went before the Supreme Court. One came out of North Carolina, where it was Republicans who were gerrymandering the districts, and the other one came out of Maryland, where it was Democrats gerrymandering the districts. And the case was pretty cut and dry in terms of the facts, because in both cases, the legislative majority admitted that what they were doing was trying to create a partisan advantage. The Democrats in Maryland said, we're trying to bury those Republicans 6 feet under. The Republicans said, we're going to build in a partisan advantage for our side of 10 Republican seats to 3 Democrats in a state that votes 50-50. And in both cases, they were pretty brazen about what their motives were.
You know, one of the things that was interesting to me when I first learned about this, you know, years ago in high school is, like, why are these shapes of these districts so weird? Why is it done this way? But when you think about it, each district has to have the same number of people in it, right? Yes. And people live in all over the place.
Yeah. So it is true that I think one of the things that people react to is oftentimes the shape of the district. And sometimes the shape of the district can tell you a little bit about the motives behind why something is the way it is. In California, we had a district where a senator lived in a poorer part of the neighborhood in Los Angeles, but decided that because he had come up in the world and he now had horses stabled in a much richer neighborhood, he wanted to draw a loop that had a tail from his neighborhood that he lived in all the way to where his horses were stabled for no good reason other than he had the power to do it. And so you see sometimes these oddball shapes, but a lot of times the shapes might also track the boundaries of a city or a community. And people don't move or create cities in nice geometric square shapes. If you look at the outlines of most cities, they tend to have fingers and protrusions everywhere.
I heard of one really brazen example. I want to say it was in North Carolina, but I'm not sure, where a state representative's individual home was actually like cut out of her district, and then she was not eligible for office.
That's
anymore.
Right. Certainly in North Carolina, but unfortunately, that is the case for most instances of gerrymandering. In fact, President Obama, when he was a rising star in the Illinois state legislature, he was attempting to run for a state Senate seat. And because in the first race that he'd run against somebody he'd lost, he bore the brunt of the next round of redistricting where they had carved his seat or his house out from a particular seat that he was looking to run in. And they literally just carved a one block nook out of the district exactly where his house was. So it happens quite commonly where these kinds of decisions are made to disadvantage an incumbent or disadvantage somebody from the minority party.
Well, we know now that the Supreme Court decided on a pretty narrow margin, 5-4, that it was not within the judiciary's purview to evaluate or to second guess the decisions of state legislatures that do this work. Could you give us a little bit of analysis on that decision and what the two different arguments in the case were?
Sure. Well, so what's interesting is that coming out of North Carolina, the legislature essentially was saying, yes, what we did was for partisan advantage. Yes, we did screw the other side over. Yes, we actually assigned a partisan score to each precinct, and we made decisions about how to draw those lines in order to assign voters to districts where we thought we could pick up the most number of seats. And they were unapologetic about it. And in fact, actually, the lawyer for the state legislature said again and again, I don't even want to talk about whether or not we could create a standard or whether or not this is the right thing to do. There is no reason for the Supreme Court to weigh in on this kind of issue. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court, even after really struggling during oral arguments about the right and wrong of this, and even in the opinion, saying that partisan gerrymandering is abhorrent to our democracy, ultimately said that it was essentially not their job to step into this and to determine whether or not there was a constitutional standard by which you could draw a line and say, these are the guardrails, and outside of that, you can't go. Unfortunately, what it ultimately does is it gives a green light to a lot of state legislatures to punish dissent, right? And what I say that this is akin to is we're verging on giving a green light to legislatures to behave as if they were the Politburo, to take away the ability for there to really be an adversarial system between two parties. And instead, once a party wins at the beginning of the decade, they can wipe the other side off the political map and control elections for the rest of the decade. That is leading us down a very dangerous path. And if we eliminate the possibility that there's real competition and choice in elections, we are potentially undermining one of the basic premises of American democracy.
You know, in some ways, it reminds me of the Citizens United decision, which opened the door for unlimited campaign contributions by corporations and private individuals. And I think it was John Roberts, the Chief Justice, who wrote the opinion in that decision as well. And he basically said, we recognize that there are negative consequences of this action, but it is protected by the Constitution, in that case, the First Amendment, or in this case, it's not an activity that's governed by the Constitution. And so what if they're taking that kind of very strict interpretation of the letter of the Constitution. Mm. How does something like that go about getting addressed?
I would say it wasn't a very strict interpretation of the Constitution. If their justification for implementing Citizens United was to allow for First Amendment protection of the ability for people to speak in the political space, right, to protect what they were saying speech was the spending of money, right? So you should be able to spend millions of dollars if you want to because that's protected speech, political speech, then by that same extension, the right of people to be able to vote and to choose candidates of their choice and to have a meaningful ability to go to an election and actually have some choices on your ballot that you can vote for and that where the outcome is not predetermined is similarly something that should be protected by the First Amendment, if not as much as even more than the right to spend millions of dollars. Because the right to vote is fundamental to the idea of what a democracy is. And so I think that this is really a hard decision to square, that the Supreme Court would protect the ability to spend millions of dollars or billions of dollars in elections, but not protect people's right to vote. Essentially, it went down on party lines. The justices who were appointed by Republican presidents voted to stay away from this issue, and those who were appointed by Democratic presidents said this is a serious problem. I think the challenge will be that, as we saw with the Maryland case, this is a problem where when Democrats are in power, they'll be just as willing to gerrymander as Republicans. And if in 2020 there is yet another blue wave, there may be multiple states that switch power in the state legislature from being Republican-held to Democratic-held. And if we haven't created guardrails when Republicans were doing it, those guardrails don't exist when Democrats do it either. And that's a very dangerous situation for our democracies. And this has nothing to do with sort of favoring one party or another. This really is just that, you know, if we want our democracy to stand, we have to make our elections mean something, which means that you got to have choices on the ballot where there's a viable option for people to actually win.
In some states, this redistricting process is handled by an independent board or commission. Do we see better results under that system, or is it still ineffective?
I might say that I'm a little biased because I am from the state of California, and I was pretty involved in helping to create the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. And in California, because we have the initiative process, which unfortunately Hawaii does not, we were able to craft a law that voters passed overwhelmingly to say that a group of 14 people who don't have any ties to politicians, who don't give major money to candidates, and who aren't, you know, related in some way to the political system, but who are themselves active, civically active, aware, and know how to run a good meeting, we're going to travel throughout the state, take testimony, and ultimately draw the lines. What we know from the California process is that some 30,000 people applied to become a commissioner, which is overwhelming because when you think about a process that most people describe as being obscure and nobody cares about, for 30,000 people to put their name in the hat and to say, hey, we care about this, and for another 20,000 people to show up to the hearings to give testimony, right there, from my perspective, that's a success. But additionally, even when the lines were challenged, our court currently has a majority of people who are appointed by Republican governors, and hands down, they had a 9-0 decision to repeatedly uphold the maps because the process had been transparent. The lines that were drawn were fair. They really respected communities and city lines. And ultimately, when it all played out, there were a fairly large number of districts that could swing either way between Democrats and Republicans, because that's just how sort of those communities were kind of coming up. And from time to time, when there's a blue wave, then those seats can be captured by Democrats. And when there's a red wave, they could be similarly captured by Republicans. In my mind, that's a true definition of a democracy that's working right, where people have the ability to elect candidates of their choice. Now, in large parts of California, like Hawaii, there are going to be a lot of people who are Democrats. And so you're not going to change that. But what you will do is change the complexion of the districts so that those districts might be drawn in a way where there might be a much healthier competition Democrat between Democrat. And that's also a good thing because it allows you to say, hey, if somebody's ideas are outdated or if there's a problem with corruption or if somebody's just been in D.C. too long and they're not responsive anymore, that you can really have a true election where you can choose somebody else. They might be from the same party, but it's an opportunity because all of the potential challengers haven't just been drawn out of that district.
What techniques does that commission use in California? I know in some earlier cases dealing with this issue, there was talk of we need an impartial statistical analysis, some sort of metric for determining if a gerrymander has occurred or not. And what is used in California?
So what's interesting is that a lot of people sometimes will ask me, hey, can we just have a computer that we could program to have, you know, a perfectly fair algorithm that could just draw the lines? And could we just remove human beings from that process? I would say that, you know, my definition of democracy is that it's not perfect. It's not like you can just plug in some numbers into a computer. What we're really looking for is civic participation from people, right? The idea that a lot of people would come. So I went to one hearing, and I showed up 2 hours early, and I really thought, like, okay, I'm going to be the only one sitting here. It's going to be quiet. I can think about my testimony. And I got there, and people were already starting to line up to go and testify. It was as if I had gone to a rock concert for some visiting band, and people had started camping out to go to this hearing because they really wanted to testify. And that's the kind of thing where when there's a revival of people feeling like there's trust that this commission is going to hear me out, that my testimony about where my community is going to be valued, and that ultimately the lines that are created are going to give me a choice, people feel like they have ownership over their government. That's a huge change in how we're now currently feeling, which is disaffected from our government, feeling a sense of distrust and a real anger. And I will say that if ultimately we want to rebuild our democracy, regardless of whether you like the current president or not, you have to believe that our government's going to work. Because if it doesn't, we are essentially ceding ground to the possibility of a dictatorship or, you know, a monarchy. And the reality is that if you feel like government doesn't work for you and you've essentially checked out, you know, we have essentially given up on the possibility of this American dream. So, you know, how do I measure, you know, whether or not California does it right? One of the ways is that when they had the hearings, as people would come up and testify, they literally had this gigantic screen behind them, and people could see the mapping happening real time. If they gave testimony that, hey, my community starts here and ends there, and, you know, you've got a potential draft line that cuts right through it, they could see the demographers kind of capturing that real time. That's the kind of feedback loop that I think, you know, in this day and age, we've come to expect, right? We see things as, and we insist that democracy should be transparent, and we should be seeing them. They shouldn't be brought to some closed-door session in a room that's rented off of the legislature, you know, for a midnight vote. They should be something where people can see how the lines are changing in real time. And then ultimately, once those draft maps are created, that people can touch them, see them, go to a website, you know, give testimony on them, and say whether they like them or don't. That has created a level of trust in California's government where we didn't have that just a few years before. We see the legislature now, some of the legislators who were elected to the state legislature right after those lines came in place, some of them who hated the idea of a citizens redistricting commission because they were giving up power, came to us and said, you know what, we've never had a more functional legislature. We talk to each other, both Democrats and Republicans. We don't always agree. We still can stay where we are, you know, in terms of, you know, politics and policy. But at least we can sit down and be civil and talk to each other and functionally work in a way where when there are major crises, whether that's figuring out what to do about climate change or our education system or building affordable housing, people can come together across the aisles and actually work as colleagues. And it's built a much more functional government because ultimately when those people go back home, they're not responding to some small donor base. They're responding to voters, and voters elected them to get something done.
So what plans do you have, does your organization have going forward? Now we have this Supreme Court decision. As I understand it, it does leave the door open for action at the state level still.
Yeah. There are really three different areas that we can move. One is to support states that have initiatives to continue passing those initiatives to reform the system. So we're seeing possible action in states like Arkansas, Oregon, and Nebraska. In states that don't, we're pushing for legislation. So states like Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Virginia, they're looking to amend their constitution or pass statutes that would essentially create some guardrails on the redistricting process. At the federal level, Congress is pushing H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and embedded in that amongst many other amazing pieces of that law that would improve access to voting. They would also require, as a bottom line matter, that every state create a citizens commission that meets certain basic minimums. And then lastly, litigation. So there are about two dozen states that have some kind of clause within their state constitution that protects free and fair elections. And we've seen in Pennsylvania that that's been a successful way of challenging the state lines and congressional lines using the state constitution. where the decision is ultimately made by a state court and it's not reviewable by the Supreme Court. So in that instance, then, we're seeing similar kinds of cases. We're supporting a case in North Carolina, Common Cause v. Lewis, where we're challenging the state legislative lines invoking the state the state constitution. And what's interesting in that particular case is that in the process of doing discovery, we have now come into possession of all of the files of the chief Republican mapmaker, Thomas Hoffler. And we are realizing the extent to which Thomas Hoffler, who is at the center of not just the redistricting in North Carolina, but in about half a dozen or a dozen states around the country, including Michigan, Texas, Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, you name where there's been a major partisan gerrymander, Thomas Hoffler was the mastermind behind that. And his files have been critical to being able to show that there really was a nexus between trying to gain a partisan advantage, but also, in his words, they wanted to push for the citizenship question on the census form in order to create redistricting that would be advantageous to, his words, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. That probably is the most groundbreaking piece of evidence that's come out so far from those files, and the reason why in another case that came out of the Supreme Court on Thursday, the Supreme Court said that the reasons that were being given by the administration were, according to the Supreme Court, contrived, that they didn't believe that it was for the purpose of protecting Latino voting rights, but that there must have been some other reason. And they kicked it back down to the lower court to have the administration essentially provide a real reason or drop the citizenship question from the census.
And the split between those two decisions seems to indicate that partisan discrimination is acceptable, racial discrimination is not.
I think that's what we are told repeatedly. And so in this case, what we're realizing is how intertwined those two motives can be. In Thomas Hoffler's files, what he did was he said, if we could create a movement for putting the citizenship question onto the census form, you could then, during redistricting, separate out who was a citizen and who wasn't, and essentially eliminate millions of Latinos from the redistricting process. And he was looking at Texas at the time, from Texas's redistricting process, and create an advantage for Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. For him to say so clearly that his goal was to advantage one party and to advantage whites, it's pretty shocking in this day and age. And I think that that's what the Supreme Court and courts throughout the country are going to be looking at very closely. If there are additional states within his files where he was coming to that same conclusion, it could cause courts to bring those states back into court supervision to say you can't make any more changes to voting laws or redistricting laws without first running it through the courts for approval, because we don't trust you anymore because you've been engaged in this wrongful racial discrimination. It's an instance where the partisan motives and the racial animus are so closely intertwined that it may give the courts the ability to curtail one, even if they're told by the Supreme Court they can't look at the other.
Interesting. So we may still see some sort of action on the redistricting issue from the courts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you will. And we'll also see a lot of action in state courts to challenge partisan gerrymanders using state constitutions. So the fight's not over. And I will say that, you know, the response from lots and lots of people around the country has been, we have won in 2018 in five states, Michigan, Ohio, Missouri, Utah, and Colorado. Those were citizen-driven actions. And there's a real kind of fire in the belly for a lot of people in multiple states, whether they have initiatives or not, to push for those kinds of reforms.
A fight on many fronts now. Kathy Fung, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.